Okay, well, welcome everyone. A very warm welcome to the Cambridge Buddhist Centre. Of course, you all know it well, and I think Maitreya Bandhu has been here quite a number of times, so I hope you'll feel at home in fairly familiar surroundings.
New curtains.
Yes, new curtains.
New floor.
And a wonderful new floor with underfloor heating, so
very nice, isn't it?
Sure we will be comfortable. So, yes, it's a great pleasure to welcome Maitreya Bandhu. He's here to talk about his work, his poetry, and how that relates to his Buddhist ideals. And I've got some questions I'm going to ask him in the first half. And then after the tea break, Maitreya Bandhu will be reading a selection of his work. Of course, in the tea break, you'll have a chance to browse the book and buy if you wish to. So, the format of this evening, I don't know, I expect one or two of you at least have been down to the very successful Poetry East events that Maitreya Bandhu has been organising for at least a couple of years now. These are at the London Buddhist Centre, as here in the Shrine Room. And it's exactly the same format we're going to be having this evening. He's been inviting, in fact, some of the most celebrated and influential poets in the country have been coming down, and there's been a very rich and interesting session of questions. Mostly, I think you've been asking them, and I think Vishvendra has on some occasions. Yeah. And it's turned out to be something actually quite unique on the English poetry scene. The poets have come and really appreciated the very calm and reflective atmosphere. And the way in which Maitreya Bandhu has been able to go into their work in some depth and ask them some really interesting questions, which they have felt has brought out things they've been reflecting on about their work, which they've been very, very happy to share. It's had a certain kind of depth and calm that they've, from what I've heard, very rarely found in the normal kind of poetry reading scene. So I hope we'll at least bring a little bit of that this evening. Of course, those events have been usually about 60 people packed in the London Buddhist Centre Shrine Room, but all to the good in a way to have a more select audience. You and certainly myself will be a lot calmer for that, I'm sure. Okay, so I'm just going to introduce Maitreya Bandhu briefly, for those of you who don't know his work. So when I was thinking about his poetry and how he's developed over the last decade or so, it immediately struck me that he's very much a poet of very close observation of the here and now. During his relatively short career, he's become known for a body of work that is precise, understated, and a record of intimate experiences. Things such as love and loss and things and places, and also what we Buddhists might well call insight, or you could simply call it a heartfelt response to how things really are. Sometimes comic, often elegiac, his poems convey the pleasures and terrors of growing up with an unusual attention to small, emotionally charged details. The celebrated poet Sean O'Brien said of his first major collection, Crumb Road, which we are launching tonight in The Guardian, "It has a rich, melancholy modesty, and to spend time with it enriches our attention," which I think is quite something to say about a collection of poetry. So, just briefly looking at his life, Maitreya Bandhu was born Ian Johnson in 1961, and he was in fact brought up in Henley-on-Arden, a lovely town in Warwickshire. His parents ran a coach firm in the High Street, and initially he trained as a nurse at the Walgrove Hospital, Coventry, but then later went on to study fine art at Goldsmiths College, London, which we may come on to later in the questions. And I believe that the well-known artists Sarah Lucas and Damien Hirst were his compatriots at the time. I don't think you got to know them very well, did you?
But Sarah knew quite well.
Okay,
Damien,
right.
Fairly well.
There we go.
So, what didn't succeed?
Notwithstanding his art college career, he became interested in attending classes at the London Buddhist Centre. This started in 1996, and very quickly, in fact, he moved into a residential community above the London Buddhist Centre in 1987. That's about 3 years after I was living there, in fact. He was ordained into our order, the Triratna Buddhist Order, in 1990, and, as you know, given the name Maitreya Bandhu. Since then, he has lived and worked at the LBC, teaching Buddhism and meditation, and being quite a major presence around the London Buddhist Centre. He's written two books on Buddhism, Thicker Than Blood, Friendship on the Buddhist Path, in 2001, and Life with Full Attention, a Practical Course on Mindfulness, from 2009, which I'm sure many of you know very well. It's been used to accompany many courses here. Now, his forthcoming Buddhist book, The Journey and the Guide, also with Windhorse, is due out in 2014. So I've mentioned Poetry East, and many well-known poets such as Joe Shapcott, David Constantine, Don Patterson and Sean O'Brien have attended and read their work. In terms of prizes, Maitreya Bandhu won the Keats Shelley Prize, also the Basil Bunting Award and the Geoffrey Dermer Prize, as well as the Ledbury for Poetry Festival competition. His first pamphlet, The Bond, won Poetry Business Book and Pamphlet Competition in 2010 and was shortlisted for the Michael Marks Award. Now, his first collection, which we're launching tonight, The Crumb Road, is published by Blood Axe, but it's also a Poetry Book Society recommendation. Maitreya Bandhu has also published articles exploring the relationship between spiritual life and poetry in magazines such as Poetry Review, Magma, Agenda, Ascent, and In Their Own Words, Contemporary Poets on Their Poetry, which is a collection of essays published by Salt, who were previously based in Cambridge, in fact. And his poems have been anthologised in both the UK and the USA. Mm-hmm. So, that's the man. And without further ado, I'm going to read one of Maitreya Bandhu's poems, just to give you a feel for his work, and I might come back to this later on, because it's quite an intriguing, mysterious poem. Okay, so it's called Lady with a Chaffinch. The heart in infrared and ultraviolet shows no underdrawing. Chromatography confirms the attribution is correct. The walnut panel is of the requisite age. The armoured soldiers on the hill, the greenwood by the cliff, the chaffinch the lady holds as she turns towards your gaze. Nothing in the underpainting suggests its provenance is in any way suspect. Sometimes the attribution is correct. So I want to start off by looking backwards a little bit. So I believed you started writing relatively late in life, or at least in terms of taking it very seriously, perhaps in your early 40s. And I do know that before that you had been a keen painter and had done Buddhist murals and other subjects, including the mural that's on the wall by the London Buddhist Centre. So the obvious question is, why the switchover? Were you, in fact, fed up with the contemporary art world? Did you maybe find more spiritual sustenance in the poetry world, which is certainly something I would say myself, but what was your response?
What might I say? I'm not sure. I came along to the Buddhist Centre, the LBC, when I was 25. I was in the second year of Goldsmiths at the time. I found Goldsmiths a very difficult place to be. It's very, very competitive. If you think squash is a competitive sport, try contemporary art. I didn't do very well in that atmosphere. I came along to the LBC. I immediately felt I was a Buddhist. And when I finished my degree, I then moved into Sukhavati, into the men's community above the LBC, and I was an artist in residence for a while, and then I gave up that to become the caretaker at the centre. It felt like something out of communist Russia. You know, I was once somebody, and then suddenly I was a nobody. I think the reason I want to say that is because, for me, some kind of art practice, I don't like any of these terms, but some kind of art practice, some kind of serious, kind of creative endeavour has always been there right from the start, before I was a Buddhist. Bhante says, doesn't he, Sangharakshita says that, you know, if you were to look for a precedent to Buddhism in the West, you'd find it in artistic traditions more than in religious traditions. For a long time I tried to paint and I tried to practice the Dharma. So I was an artist in residence at this school. Then I was a caretaker for a while. Then I'd sort of try and paint in my room in Sukhavati, and then I'd paint on retreats and so on. I never found it very easy to put the two together. I've always had an ambivalent relationship with the arts. It's very important to me, and at the same time I'm a bit dubious about the arts, really.
Do you mean the visual arts? Or
all of them, really.
The whole thing, okay.
I mean that in a nice way. Yes. But, you know, there's pros and cons in it, isn't there? There's all kinds of pros and cons. What I'd hoped was that I could just give myself a spiritual life, and that I wouldn't need a kind of art aspect of my life. And for a while that was true, and then I wrote Thicker Than Blood, which I really enjoyed writing, and I'd never written a book before or even considered writing a book. So I really enjoyed that. So for a while I thought, okay, I didn't need to. And before I knew it, I was directing an opera, and I was painting the mural of the... So it just kept... However I tried to run my life, some kind of artistic element to it kept popping out. Poetry had never been particularly important to me. When I was at art school, the only person I'd read was Eliot. But the turning point came really when I was on a... I went to Australia and New Zealand with Dave Mitra when he was the overall Mitra convener. And Dave Mitra's had him with their own nose, and he was very outspoken. And I remember saying, well, T.S. Eliot's wonderful. I mean, I've not read him to be I don't know quite who what I thought. But he said, well, Shelley's a much greater poet than Eliot. And I thought, no, he's not. I had not read a word of Shelley. But, I didn't want him to be, excuse me. And David Mitchell, then what he did, he just found a book in the collected poems of Shelley in the bookcase. Uh-huh. And he read the first five verses of The Mask of Anarchy.
Oh, The Mask of Anarchy.
In his blood-curdling voice. He's an actor. Brilliant. And I remember listening to it and just thinking, that's fantastic. That is fantastic. Hmm. It was a bit like the first time I saw Van Gogh's paintings when I was in Amsterdam. You just think, I've got to do that. I've got to do that. I didn't particularly think I'd got to do Shelley. I mean, what that did is it led me to read all of Shelley, and then I read all of Keats. And then Keats, I really loved Shelley. It was my first great love, in a way. I mean, Shelley is fantastic. And then I read, you know, Shelley knew Keats slightly at the same time, so I read all of Keats. Keats took me a longer time to get into, but I came to love Keats. And then Keats, a poem that I really loved of Keats, had been influenced by Coleridge and Dante. So I went off and read Coleridge. These are great poems of Coleridge, a lot, and the biography. And then I also read Dante, Divine Comedy. I read it three times.
Okay.
I read it once. I read each canto once without notes, then once with notes, and then once without notes. Heaven's a bit boring.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Got its good moments. But I really got into Dante. So for a long time, I didn't even consider writing. I think even now, I wouldn't want to call myself a poet. I think a poet is something people call you when you're dead. It's a bit like calling yourself a saint, calling yourself a poet. So I never thought of writing, but I'd always written, you know, poems on retreat when I felt unhappy.
So this reading Dante phase, when would that have been?
Oh, I don't know. That would be about, let's say, 1995.
Okay.
So it went on for ages.
Yeah, yeah.
The real change was I went on the sabbatical in 2007, the idea was to write this book on art and Buddhism.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Which I've been trying to write for years.
Yes.
But it's painting and Buddhism.
Yeah.
And I tried to write it, and I must have spent like 4 months on it. A long time, every morning writing it. And I really disliked writing it. I couldn't write it. Yarnovacher came to see me halfway through, my good friend Yarnovacher, and he said he was neither impressed with the book or with me.
Oh, dear.
So I said, OK, I won't write anymore. So I then, for the rest of the sabbatical, about 3 and 4 months, I just painted and wrote poems. And at the time, I thought I'd go back to art school.
Right.
That was my intention. Actually, what I did, I came back and oversaw the building project at the RBC. But out of that time came writing poems. I started writing poems. And one of the poems in here even dates back to that time. Only one. But then I typed them up for one of the first. I never typed them up before even. And I showed them to a friend of ours, Miss Ventura. And she was encouraging, and that was all I needed. I was off. And now I'm completely obsessed.
Yes.
About writing poems. But
And the idea of going back to art college, that just dropped away, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows you, really. I mean, at the time, I remember having really good reasons to go back to art college, and then when I didn't get in, which was laughable, I mean, I was doing these watercolours, they probably just thought, ha-ha-ha, I'm a middle-aged person. I'm doing watercolours, you know, how embarrassing. They weren't even ironic. So I didn't have a chance, really.
Right.
And, you know, not getting in, actually, I think it's been much better. It wouldn't have been any good. But poetry feels to me exactly like painting.
Oh, that's quite interesting.
Not in its sort of detail, but in the underlying thing, it's exactly the same process of painting, exactly the same, spookily the same. Even the same in the details, like when I used to paint, you know, I'd work and work and work on something for ages, then get really frustrated with it. And often, when I eventually pulled it off, they were the best ones. When I was painting, I think, oh, it's going to be like this, and it actually was a reverse of that. All the things that I used to experience in painting, exactly the same in poetry. The great thing about poetry is I can carry it around with me, basically. So, you know, like on the way here, I was fiddling with trying to find a rhyme for lamps on the train, you know, things like that. So it feels like it's the first time in my spiritual life I've managed to find an art form that I can actually integrate into spiritual life. I just couldn't do that with painting. People used to say to me, well, you need to make your art your spiritual life, and I don't think it's as simple as that. I wish it was.
That's interesting. I wonder why that was, because you would have thought that certainly the aspects of close observation could be very much part of a practice of painting.
Yeah. Why that I don't think it's simple, you know, that...
Yeah. Yeah.
It just doesn't feel like that to me.
Hmm.
Why do I think that? Yeah, I just feel that there's so much egotism that gets caught up in art.
Yes.
And in the West particularly, art still has a lot of kudos. You know, it's well known that there's lots of people who have art studios that they never go to. You know, but they pay rent week on week. And they won't give it in because they've got this idea they want to be an artist. I think when I was painting, it was very isolating. I didn't think that was very good for me. And writing, the writing has been much better, but what it's done is re-evoke my ambition.
Mm.
And there's always something ugly and point-missing about ambition. So I just don't... I think we need a much more nuanced discussion about art and spiritual practice. I just don't think it's as simple as that. It's a bit like people sometimes try and say that, you know, family life is a practice. It's just not as simple as that. It needs to become, but it's not as simple as that. There are very strong worldly aspects in the arts. There's lots of egotism involved in it. There's this kudos, which is is seductive but dangerous. I mean, in art, there was no danger of success. that never happened, don't you? With poetry, there has been that success to a very limited, little tiny degree, has become more of an issue.
Right, okay.
And it's rather bad for you.
Yes, I was wondering, this is a bit of a shot in the dark, really, but is it at all something to do with the fact that in poetry you're, as it were, bringing together the emotional and the cognitive? So in poems there are ideas, explicitly. And was that part of the reason you found it easier to connect it with your spiritual practice than painting?
Might have been.
Yeah.
I think it feels more practical.
Okay.
That it was just more that... I mean, it feels like that, but it isn't literally like you thought, what should I do, paint or write poems? This one is more practical, I'll do that one. So it can't really be that.
Wouldn't have thought so.
There's a certain weird way in which... And this might be a post hoc that actually I was trying to age my way towards writing all the time.
Interesting, yes.
You know, I'm very verbal.
Yes,
I spend a lot of my time talking. You know, there's a sense in which more and more recently it feels like I was always meant to write. And that I've spent all this time trying to find my way to what I was meant to do.
Yes.
That it feels a much closer fit to me in some ways than painting.
Right.
But I don't know whether that's a post hoc thing. And of course the great thing about poetry is I can say things like I can when I'm teaching.
Yes,
which I can never say.
I was trying to hint at.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I can never do that in painting.
Yeah.
The lovely thing about painting, of course, is that you can just say, "What do you think of that one?" I think, "Oh, I like that." Whereas poems, people, you know, you go, people think, "Well, I'm not a poetry person." Or you think, "Well, a lot of white, you know, it's not a, you know, you can't just enjoy it simply."
Yeah.
And when I was writing on this sabbatical, I thought, "Oh, I should wish I'd be painting," because then you can just say, "Well, look at that one. Oh, that's nice." You know, I rather, it's a shame that poetry's not like that. You can't just hold them up and go, "Oh, yes." But yeah, they're not quite like that. But yes, you can say something. And I think it might have been that I have to have that. You have to be able to say something.
Right, okay. So, moving on. Next question is a very simple one.
I'll try and be a bit shorter in my answer.
Yeah. You've already mentioned some influences, romantic poets, Dante, and so on. Would you like to say a bit more about your major poetic influences, perhaps?
Yes.
A bit more into the 20th century.
Yeah, let's try and get into the 20th century. I mean, it's worth saying that everyone you read influences you. I mean, it's interesting, when you send poems off for competitions, it has to be all your own work. It never is all your own work. Not really, can't be. Everything you've read influences you. Your mentors influence you. You know, it's never really yours, quite. It's not yours either, but... So all of those people influence me, although I don't think... I remember in one of the poems I tried to write a Shelley-like poem.
Yeah, I don't pick up a lot of
There's no Shelley at all.
No.
I'd love to write much Shelley. I don't have it in me. I don't know anybody. I mean, Wallace Stevens is the great inheritor of Shelley's mantle, I think. Not many people can reach that kind of thing. I can't, anyway. My main influences that I think of anyway are Elizabeth Bishop, who I cannot speak highly enough of. Has everybody read Elizabeth Bishop? Hands?
Yeah, a little bit.
I mean, a collected poem is only tiny. Yeah. There's no excuse. She's utterly readable. She's always very, very... she uses very straightforward language, in a certain sense at least. She's not a difficult poet. She's not an obscure poet. Almost everything I've read by her, I would rate. Her letters are wonderful, comic... funny, wonderfully written. Her poems are, well, clearly some of the major work of the 20th century. I have a strong feeling for her work, and you can see her influence in the poems, I think. And then the other poet that's majorly influenced me, I think, is Robert Frost. The poem that sort of introduces the whole collection is very Frostian. Robert Frost has become a major influence, and interestingly, Frost was a major influence on Heaney. I think that 20th century poetry, you could always trace it either from Frost or from Eliot. So Eliot tends to... You go down from Eliot to, you know, sort of more difficult contemporary poets like Geoffrey Hill or something like that. Frost, you end up with Heaney. Frost's poems are... He's not quite as... He's sort of almost as plain-spoken as Bishop. He's a generation before Bishop, both of course American poets. He's got this beautiful, he writes in perfect pentameter, but in a very easy style. When you read, I particularly like the long narratives, when you read them at first, you think, yeah, it's all right. It's really, they're very, they don't show up very much, but they're wonderful. If you, you know, the book to read of Frost is North of Boston, that's his great collection, just about every poem in it is a master. Yeah, so those two particularly.
That's fascinating, yes. Okay, so now the surprise question. I was always going to have one that's...
No, it's good to have a surprise.
So actually, it's very simple. I wanted to ask you about that poem that I read, Lady with the Chaffinch.
Yes, I like that. I'm glad you like that. It's, well, I presume you like it.
It's very intriguing, mysterious. And, of course, it refers to painting, your first love, as it
yeah,
were.
Yes.
And that comes through very strongly. And it seems to have some sort of message, but it's quite hard to say exactly what that might be. Hmm. Having read it a few times, I was starting to get something... Well, two things, actually. Something about candidness and honesty. It seemed to be something about human communication and how sometimes what we share, what we give out... is really who we are. It's not an artifice, less of an artifice than normal. So I was partly getting that. And then also there was something about this thing of attribution in paintings, finding the correct artist, the correct label, which actually completely fits. Yes, it is a Van Gogh or whoever. There seemed to be something in there about... I know you have a great love of clarity, clarity of thought, which is perhaps a different, slightly different side to your life, but it seemed to be coming out in this poem. Something about the importance of at certain points in life just being clear about what's what and fitting the correct concept onto the situation. So I really wanted to ask, is that what's going on? Do you have any thoughts about this poem?
I think there's something of that. It's worth saying when you write poems, there's a sort of conscious element and an unconscious element. And you're trying to... You can't write too consciously. Also, you can't write too unconsciously, otherwise you wouldn't write at all. But so I think it has got some of those things in. In my mind, it's a meditation poem.
Yes.
As many of the poems in the central section are.
Yeah.
In fact, more of the poems in the book are meditation poems than people realise. So some of the poems look like they're biographical poems, but they're actually meditation poems. I think what I was trying to say is that... or what I thought I was trying to say, you never quite know, is that I have a rather self-doubting nature. I think that's just the sort of nature. I've got slightly melancholic, self-doubting nature. And I easily question my own motivations, question my own spiritual depth, question my own spiritual authenticity and all that sort of thing. And this came out of a meditation where I thought, where I felt in the meditation, no, sometimes I can just trust. And sometimes we can just trust our heart, you know.
So when I say
the heart in infrared or ultraviolet shows no underdrawing, chromatography confirms the attribution is correct. So it's about chromatography. These are all techniques for showing whether a Renaissance painting particularly is historically the attribution is correct. So the metaphor is that there is no... It isn't a fake. You're not a fake, after all. One's fears that we possibly all have, that we're not really genuine, fond of nowadays. We're rather too keen on problem and complexity and distancing and irony and self-doubt and so forth. At least I think I easily fall into that. And I just wanted to say sometimes the attribution is correct. Sometimes metta, loving kindness, is metta, loving kindness. It's not some strange something else. This is to me that, you know, I put the last sentences, the armoured soldiers on the hill, the greenwood by the cliff, the chaffinch the lady holds as she turns towards your gaze. Nothing in the underpainting suggests its provenance is in any way suspect. Sometimes the attribution is correct. So it's trying to say, actually, sometimes what it looks like is what it is. Sometimes as human beings, we're so easily not, but sometimes the act of kindness actually is an act of kindness. Sometimes the attribution is correct. I wanted to affirm human authenticity, spiritual authenticity, like the authentication of a painting. That's the metaphor, you know. It was actually sparked by reading an article in the London Review of Books about the authentication of painting.
And did you have a particular painting in mind, or was it just a general sense of a Renaissance?
No, although there's a Raphael painting of a Madonna and a chaffinch, which is very badly abraded.
Right.
Raphael's very, you know, with a great love of mine. So I've sort of got a Raphael Leonardo-ish painting in mind.
Yes,
I've laid it up.
It was the lady with the ferret, fun enough. It made me think.
That's probably
I don't quite
in my
know
mind,
why, but, which is sort of very, very clear, almost hyper-real.
Yeah. So it made me think wonderful, yeah. It's got something of that.
Yeah.
It would be a Raphael or a Leonardo of that kind.
Sure. Yeah.
Turning towards you, holding a chaffinch.
Yeah.
And of course, the lady is important because it's a metaphor for the soul, usually, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it has to be a she. The chaffinch, I think that, I don't know what that is, I like birds.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's something about the soul would have wings. You know, it would have to be that. The green wood is, a sort of nature idol. You know, somehow that's important.
Mm. Thank you. That was actually illuminating. Yeah.
That's nice.
Okay, so next one, it really arises out of a few things we've already touched on. I would say personally, Buddhism is a fairly quiet presence in your work. It is there, but often mentioned very explicitly. And also, to me, your fairly understated voice, it seems very English, almost Larkin-esque.
Yeah, if only Crikey.
And certainly not obviously influenced by Far Eastern Buddhist poetics, Tang Dynasty and all that kind of thing, as much American poetry has been. But obviously you are a deeply committed Buddhist, and I know that you value clarity about the Buddhist teachings, as I've already mentioned, very highly. And you are keen on the avoidance of a woolly sentiment in spiritual matters. So I wonder, therefore, in what sense you feel you are a Buddhist poet, if those concepts rarely make their presence felt explicitly.
Your work, yeah.
I think this is perhaps the big question.
Do you think it's a good, really good question, I think. My first response to it is that I don't like Buddhism in poetry. There are quite a lot of contemporary poets who refer explicitly to Buddhism, both English and American. I'm thinking someone like John Burnside.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Other people have. Usually I don't buy it.
Mm.
It feels Buddhism from the outside, like so many films of Buddhism. You just think, no, Buddhism's not really like that. That's just the costume of Buddhism. Usually it turns me off, if you see me. Can hardly think of an example where it doesn't. I'm not been drawn to write in that way. And I'm not, for instance, particularly influenced by Zen poetry, although
no,
I love Zen poetry.
It doesn't seem so,
Nor the haiku. I have written a haiku and it's rubbish. I actually don't think haikus work in English. That's what Bishop thought, and I think I agree with her. She just thought they just don't work in English. The English language just doesn't have that kind of texture. I think I agree. But what I hope is that, you know, they're Buddhist poems to the degree to which I'm a Buddhist. If I have to put Buddhism into it self-consciously, then that makes me uneasy.
Yeah.
I mean, many of the poems directly come out of meditation, either about meditation or appeared in meditation. But I don't like writing about Buddhism. I want them to have the atmosphere of a Buddhist. and I want them to be poems that anyone could relate to. I mean, having said that, my next collection, which I've been working on for ages, I mean, in a way, I feel like this is half of my collection I've got. My next collection will be the second half. In my mind, anyway. Nobody else will know that, but that's really in my mind. I've got two long poems, long poems. They'll be like 9-10 pages long. Both of them about the Buddha, or at least where the Buddha is an actual character that you meet and is described. And
good heavens.
Indeed. So they're very, I mean, they couldn't be more explicit. Mm. He actually speaks. They're sort of blank verse, long narrative poems about the Buddha. And I will have even some prayers for the Buddha in it, I think, probably, if I can ever finish them.
Right.
So probably the next collection will be a bit more overt in places. But, there's religious content and then there's religious form.
Yes.
And I really hope that the book is pervaded by Buddhist values. Part of that value is the value of excellence, I think. I think that itself is a value. You don't get brownie points for being spiritual. There's no excuse for bad writing, I don't think. I don't care who you are. If Owen can write great poetry in a trench, so no difficult situations let you off bad writing, but also no laudable situations let you off bad writing either. Well, it's a bit like painting. Unless it's actually in the work, I'm not interested. Unless it's in front of you, it doesn't count. If you have to say, but the writer or the painter is of this, so what? It has to be in the work. And everything has to be sacrificed for the work, including overt things that just don't fit. I have tried to be overt at times and I don't seem to manage it. I mean, Rangitaya, which is the longest, most ambitious poem, in my mind is a fully metaphysical Buddhist poem, but I think my instinct is to speak that in a very, very understated voice that you wouldn't necessarily realise that I'm talking about larger things at all.
Right.
Which is, I feel mixed about whether I'm happy with that or not.
Well, it sounds as if perhaps putting this other poem in the voice of the Buddha is a way around that.
Yeah.
Because it's, as it were, not you speaking in that case. Yeah.
That seems to be the only way I can do it directly, is to create a narrative which the Buddha is a character in.
Right, yes.
Rather than me talking to him in my voice.
Yes. I mean, well, it'd be very interesting to see those.
Yes, and that'd be very long. Yeah. If I ever finish them. They're still in parts on the floor at the moment.
Okay, so the next one is a rather topical question arising from the very sad recent death of Seamus Heaney.
Mm.
I wondered if you'd like to say perhaps a few words about how he's influenced you, or maybe even one or two, allude to one or two favourite poems of his that you've gone back to over the years.
Yeah, I mean, Heaney is a wonderful poet. I interviewed, for Poetry, so I interviewed the Irish poet Bernard O'Donoghue, who I really very highly rate as well, a wonderful poet. And he said he thought we were fortunate to be living at the same time as Heaney.
Mm.
He's a close friend of, was a close friend of Seamus Heaney. My memory, I mean, I've read, before I started reading contemporary poetry more, which I am nowadays, he was the only contemporary poet I read. That's true of many people. For many people, he is the only contemporary poet anyone reads, if they read poetry at all. And that's given him, unfortunately, a bad press, and people are jealous of it. But actually, he's wonderful. I mean, really, really wonderful. I remember I was reading him on that sabbatical, and I was reading lots of other poets at the time, contemporary poets, and when you get to Heaney, you're unmistakably in deeper terrain. It's a more generous voice, a larger voice. You feel that you're meeting somebody with a much greater purchase on the nature of things. Mm. I don't particularly like the Bog poems very much. They don't particularly touch me, but nearly everything he writes about his family, for me, is wonderful. Every time he mentions his father, his mother, his grandmother, it's wonderful. Things like Seeing Things, that collection, is wonderful. He's technically brilliant. But he's so generous. And such a, no one's got a bad word to say about him. Mm. When I reread them when he died, I thought I wanted to reread Heaney. And I was surprised to see how much he had influenced me. In fact, I have I've written two poems recently which are too influenced by him, and I had to push him back.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's fantastic. Read something like A District in Circle, which is wonderful.
Thank you for that. Okay, so next one, referring to the review by Sean O'Brien in The Guardian. He made some very interesting remarks there, and he said you're interesting for being someone who notices and for the care you bring to your observation of people, events, places and memories. But then he went on to say that unlike Thomas Hardy and most other poets, you're inclined to be self-effacing. He made quite a thing of this self-effacingness. So I'm wondering, well, assuming you agree with Sean O'Brien, to what would you attribute that quality? And to make a slightly personal remark, to me you seem to be quite an extroverted person.
No.
Not especially self-effacing. You've been a very active, confident teacher at a major urban Buddhist centre for many years. But there's something else in your poetry. Have you talked about that?
I mean, I really liked Sean's review. Although, interestingly, he doesn't mention any of the spiritual poems in the middle. Probably because, you've got to make a particular take on someone. And the take that he's taken is sort of the sort of world of poetry he would probably appreciate. But I was very—I hope—I hope they are self-effacing. But it is odd because I'm not. if anything, in my actual life, I'm given to overstatement. I get into trouble for again and again. I am given to overstatement. I won't get constantly in trouble for it, but I've often been in trouble for it, and sort of rightly so. So it is a bit, I thought your question was very good, because it is a bit odd that in my poems I, if anything, go to understatement. I can't overstate in poetry. I've tried to sort of be more emphatic. Mostly I then erase it.
Yeah.
For instance, I'm writing a poem about a woman, Jane, who brought me up, and I've wanted to write about her for a long time. She was a very very typical English lady, country lady. She was sort of tagged onto my family and helped bring me up. I've got three brothers and a sister, and my mother was used to drive coaches, so she used to wake me up for school and get me ready for school and all that sort of thing. I wasn't very nice to her. And she was killed in an accident. We had a coach and taxi firm, and she was, she was killed outright taxiing someone when I was about 14, I think. And I remember very shamefully. She used to always tell me, "I'm going off to do Mrs. Lewis now," which she used to do every day, and that was a particular taxi job. And I used to clap sarcastically. She'd always tell me, even though I knew perfectly well that's what she was doing. Which, of course, when I came to so terribly regret that. And in our family, as in this sort of English thing, after she died, we never talked about her. Even though she's such an important part of our family.
Right.
But then how do you write about it? So all I managed to write in the poem is the death. I talk about the policeman coming up. I remember the policeman coming up the yard, and all I could write about is that all I could say is the news he brought was never talked about. So write about her here, and then write about all the things I remember: her shelling peas, the socking seams that she had. She used to. She told me once that she had she was sweet on somebody during the war. My instinct is to preserve that. But yeah, I in poetry I seem to be given to understatement. I think partly I was thinking that when you teach, you're trying to convince, partly. You're trying to say this is important, this. And I think with someone with my temperament, that will draw me to overstatement. I think I am given to that anyway. I'm an extrovert. I think out loud. I rather like the sound of my own voice at times. I'm a natural show-off, or I used to be. I'm not so much now. So I think personality, that is true, but in the poetry I'm trying to discover something, and in the poetry I'm sort of whispering to myself. I'm not I'm not trying to convince anyone. I'm trying to think, what is it? What can I say about her? Or in the Stephen sequence, what happened? Did that happen? Was that then or was that then? And did I think that or did I just think I think that? You know, so that the poems are very introverted. And they're me whispering to myself, trying to think, is that true though? And so it brings out a very, very different part of my character. It actually, I think, it is a deeper part of my character.
Yes, and presumably one that's always been there.
Presumably,
yeah. In a certain way, yes.
I think I instinctively don't feel sure of life. It's difficult to communicate this because I'm not often in situations where I can. But I just don't know. I more and more as I get older, I just haven't a clue about hardly anything. I don't know. I can't be sure. As Sangrach says, I won't be sure. I can't be sure. I won't be sure. I don't know about life. I just don't know. I can't decide. I feel ambivalent. I have mixed feelings. I don't know. I can't be sure. And that feels to me actually a much deeper aspect of me than my sort of character, which is more kind of colourful. But that's my sort of character. I've always been like that.
Yes, I see. Yes.
I've never really had a place to express my sense of I just don't know. Things feel so crumbly and unreal to me. I can't grasp anything. I can't be confident. I'm surrounded by all these confident people and I don't feel that kind of confidence. I don't think I ever will have it. In the poems, I don't need to. I can just sort of think, yes. You know. I've never found a way of expressing it. It's only in the poems. It's not even in the books I wrote. In the Dharma books, it's not in my talk.
Okay.
I can't find a place for it. Apart from the poems. The poems have given me a way of talking about things that I've never been able to talk about.
Gosh, yeah.
Including things I didn't know I needed to talk about.
Right, fascinating. Yeah. That's really fascinating. Okay, well, time is rushing. I did want to just ask you about the major sequence in here before we close.
Yeah.
Stephen. Quite a number of poems about this teenage affair. They're very touching and tender, I feel, but somehow they don't come across quite as love poems. Okay. Again, going back to Sean O'Brien's review, he said something along the lines of Stephen and yourself in the poems, you don't seem to know each other or yourselves at all. Mm. It's as if everything is hidden. Mm. Your meetings are hidden in various hedgerows and dells in the countryside, and you seem metaphorically hidden from yourselves. I wonder if you could say a bit more about that.
Yes, I mean, in a way, the sequence of 21 poems, it's the most ambitious part of the book. The most ambitious single poem is Rangitaire, which took me 95 drafts and 3 years to write.
Heavens.
I thought, they take so long. This is 7 years' work. You know, people read it and think, yeah, it's quite nice. I like the one that rhymed. It doesn't look like they worked very much at all, but anyway, the sequence about Stephen took me years and years to write. I didn't realise I was writing a sequence at first. When I did, suddenly I wrote much more. They're not love poems, I don't think, but they're not love poems.
That was it, yes.
They're sort of... Love is talked about.
Yes, yes. And they're not lust poems either,
God heavens, no. Yes. I mean, the rudest word is naked, and that I had to, you know, have a run about. But it should come as a shock in the context of the poem, the word naked. I mean, it's terribly sad because, we had this relationship between when I was 8 and when I was 16. He was killed when I was 16. Of course, his death means that it backlights the whole thing. I could never talk to him about it. I could never say, yeah, but what happened? What do you think about it? They're not love poems. They're not lust poems. They're poems of reconsideration. Poems of what happened.
Yeah.
What did I feel? Mm. What did he feel? What did it mean? And what's interesting about them, all the feeling is displaced to the landscape.
Yes.
It's as if he became the landscape. If anything, a set of landscape poems in a certain sense. All of the sort of feeling is thrown out into the landscape.
Yes.
So they're often about walking somewhere in which we would, I mean, sex is far too grand a term. We would sort of do something of a teenage or prepubescent nature, of which I can barely remember a thing. And, you know, the actual sort of pre-sexual or sexual element was really, I hardly remember at all and don't feel moved to write about. But yet it seemed to make the landscape alive with something which was forbidden to me. We never talked. Nobody knew we knew each other. When I went to his funeral, nobody knew why I was there. And he was a working class boy. I wasn't what I sort of am, but it didn't appear to be. And there was a sort of class divide between us.
So how did you meet him?
I can remember. We were at a junior school together.
Okay.
Yeah. So we went to Wootton. He went to a new junior school, and then I went with him.
Hmm.
I can't really remember how it started.
Yeah.
We used to do these things called refreshers, which is when you pulled your shirts off and you lay on top of each other. And I found it incredibly pleasurable. I was only about eight.
Yeah.
I just thought that was wonderful. sorry to bring the tone down, but that's about as rude as I'll get, you know. I didn't know. But I think the difference, you see, between... I think any kind of prepubescent, early sexual experience, pre-sexual experience, it's always rather difficult, isn't it? It's fraught with problems and feelings. The difference between relationships between the same sex is that we could never talk about it.
Mm.
So we never said, what's happening? As far as we were concerned, nothing was happening.
Yes.
Nothing was happening. Nothing happened.
Mm.
And yet it kept on, that nothing kept on happening.
Yeah.
But nothing was happening. Nobody knew we knew each other. We weren't friends.
Mm.
Not really. Sort of, you know, complex. So the whole sequence was born out of not knowing and being haunted by him. I mean, literally haunted, like there's a poem about haunting in it.
Yeah.
I was on a solitary retreat, and when I used to meditate, particularly in the early days, if I got deeper in meditation, he'd appear. Not literally, but particularly seemed to be to do with my legs. If I relaxed my legs, he'd be there. And one time I was on solitary and I was washing up, and suddenly he was standing behind me. It was so vivid, to the point to which I actually said, Stephen, you know,
gosh,
what do you want?
Yeah.
And my sense was that he was wanting to ask me something. He was sort of trying to ask me something. And then he seemed to sort of think, oh, you know, okay, it's not worth it. And then turned away.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, I got a few more poems about Stephen in the next collection, including a Sestina, two Sestina, which I've not published yet. And then I recently thought, I wanted to see whether to write about him again. And I went back to all the places in my mind, and he's gone. It's completely gone.
As if the ghost's been exorcised or something like that.
Yeah, I really don't know. It's a bit like Dante talking about helping people from the dead.
Yeah.
He's just not there. It's really weird.
Right.
Because I can go back to that childhood landscape very vividly.
Mm.
It's as vivid to me as any landscape, probably more so.
Yeah.
He's not there anymore.
Right.
He was always there every time I went back.
Yeah.
He was there. He's not there now. There's nowhere. I've looked everywhere. He's not there.
Right.
He's gone.
Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah.
Most peculiar. I never expected it.
Yeah.
I've got nothing else to say about him after these last ones that I wrote.
Yeah.
He's gone.
Mm. Well, on that note, I do have a few more questions, but time is rushing on, so I think we'd better leave it there. Maitreya Bandhu, many thanks. That was a very rich hour, absolutely fascinating. And I think it set us up very nicely for hearing you read some of your own work. So anyway, we'll give you a bit of a hand now.